setting of our text this morning is Jesus' hometown synagogue in Nazareth. And the occasion is the commencement of his public ministry. Jesus is welcomed, even praised, and invited to read from the sacred scroll. All goes well with the reading, but when he sat down to teach what the prophecy meant for the assembled congregation, they flew into a rage and drove him out of their midst and their city. The text is part of a larger story in Luke 4, verses 14 through 30. And I'll come back to that larger story after I introduce my reason for turning to this particular text. I have in mind a theme of setting captives and prisoners free. And more importantly, I have in mind persons who have returned from prison and find that they are not free, find that they are still in chains. Prisoners and former prisoners are outsiders. They are not only maligned and marginalized in our society, but they carry a permanent stigma, a scarlet letter that forever identifies them as an enemy of the state, subject not only to legal penalty, but also to divine punishment for their rejection of God's peace. In the words of a dear friend who returned to community 2 years ago after serving 25 years in prison, prison is the gift that keeps on giving. In other words, no matter the length of your sentence, no matter how long you've been out, no matter how hard you've worked to lead a good life, terms like convict and felon negate your moral worth and undermine your human dignity as a child of God. Felons and ex-felons are outsiders. In our context, in the days in which we live, in this era of hyper-incarceration of black males, the militarization of police forces, the privatization of prisons, in this context, people who return from prison are the undeserving poor. They are the null curriculum. Not important to know, not important to society, and not important to the church. My interest in the text concerns the good news for these outsiders at the very bottom of society. They are among the most vulnerable of the poor. As a social caste, they are excluded from any meaningful participation in society and condemned to a permanent economic and social underclass, wherein the light of deliverance and healing often fails to shine. They are stigmatized for breaking civil and religious law, and no matter how earnestly they work, how hard they try, they can never break the chains that bind them. What is the good news for prison residents and returning citizens? My question has a political dimension, a theological dimension, and also an ethical dimension. Politically, in Louisville, as in cities across the country, a prison stay of any length is exactly what Michelle Alexander described in The New Jim Crow. It is a gateway into a much larger system of stigmatization and permanent marginalization. Regaining even basic civil rights is largely dependent on where the returning citizen lives. For example, each U.S. state falls within one of five categories on the severity of its felon voting laws. In 10 states, Ex-felons may lose their right to vote permanently. In 20 states, voting privileges are restored after the prison term, parole, and probation are fully completed. In 4 states, the vote is restored after prison term and parole. In 14 states and Washington, D.C., the vote is restored after the prison term. And in only 2 states, offenders may vote from prison. If you guess those states were Maine and Vermont, you are correct. In Kentucky, Governor Steve Beshear issued an executive order in November 2015 to automatically restore the right to vote to nonviolent felons who completed their prison term, probation, parole, and who had no court-ordered restitution. About a month later, newly elected Governor Matt Bevin issued an executive order rescinding that order. And as a result, people convicted of any felony in Kentucky are permanently barred from voting by state constitution and must individually apply with the governor to have their voting rights restored. Kentucky's felony disenfranchisement law is one of the 10 harshest in the nation. This is certainly not good news for returning citizens. The permanent second-class status of poor and oppressed people who have been residents of prison stands in stark contrast to the obvious meaning of setting prisoners and captives free. If the church's mission is to be the body of Christ and to preach the gospel, then what is the gospel for prisoners and returning citizens? Does the church participate in the permanent second-class status of these outsiders? We may use words like deliverance, redemption, restoration, liberation, and release to provide an easy and often spiritualized answer to the question, but we know from the testimony of returning citizens that their chains are not broken. We also know that the church does not speak with one voice on whether their chains should be broken. English translations of the passage from Isaiah chapter 61 trouble the interpretive waters. In the New Revised Standard Version, for example, Isaiah 61 states that the prophet will proclaim liberty to the captives and release to the prisoners. In the Luke 4 text, however, this citation appears in a modified form. Luke proclaims that Jesus has been sent to proclaim release to captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free. There's no explicit mention here of prisoners. In its place is a proclamation about freeing those persons, blind and oppressed, from their suffering. In the Common English Bible version of Luke's account, Jesus proclaims release to the prisoners and recovery of sight to the blind to liberate the oppressed. Take just one more. The King James Version, American edition, states that Jesus was sent to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised. The selective use of the term prisoner in English translations as a way to convey what Isaiah had in mind is not merely a quibble over words. Much more is at stake. To illustrate what is at stake, I recently came across a children's sermon online in which the author recommends that when we talk to young children about Jesus setting prisoners free, we should use a theological disclaimer to specify and delimit the scope of freedom in Luke's account. For example, we might say something like, when the Bible talks about Jesus setting prisoners free, it doesn't mean that Jesus is freeing people from jail. I wonder what the implications are for children who receive this message. I wonder if they get the message that prisoners who deserve to be freed are not the people in jail or prison. I wonder if they get the message that the people in jail are undeserving of the freedom that Jesus brings. I wonder how the children of prison residents and returning citizens receive this message. I wonder how returning citizens themselves receive this message. I wonder how this theology informs the faithful on the politics of disenfranchisement. So what does it mean to set the prisoners free? And who are the prisoners and captives in Isaiah 61? The expression proclaiming liberty to the captives is a frequently used expression in connection with the year of Jubilee in Leviticus 25 and with the manumission of slaves in Jeremiah 34. The context is God's consolation to an oppressed people after the exile. The exiles returned expecting emancipation and Jubilee, expecting wealth and peace and justice, but found chaos and confusion, poverty and moral declension, mismanagement. They had no idea what was happening to them or why it was happening. Some in Israel suspected that God's heart was hardened against them. But in 2 Isaiah, in Isaiah 42, God reminds Israel that they have seen many things but not observed them. God is not raining down disasters on Israel. The spirit of heaviness that hangs like a pall over Israel will dissipate like a fog in the morning sun if only Israel will accept and receive what God has been trying to do for them all along. The prophet's task of proclaiming release to captives is closely related to an expression in Isaiah 42. Verses 6 and 7, I created you and appointed you a covenant people, a light of nations, opening eyes deprived of light, rescuing prisoners from confinement, from the dungeon, those who sit in darkness. The historical backdrop of exile and return frames an understanding of who the prisoners are that Isaiah refers to. The theme itself of prisons and prisoners to illuminate a theological message is not uncommon in the Bible. Imprisonment in biblical times took various forms. In the Hebrew Bible, accused persons were often confined while their cases were being investigated. We can find evidence of this in Genesis, in 1 Kings, and elsewhere. In the New Testament, Roman magistrates remanded accused persons to civil or military prisons, or release them on bail or personal recognizance. Prisons were often dark, desolate places without windows. Accused prisoners were generally held with condemned persons. Conditions in ancient prisons were not too far removed from some conditions today: overcrowding, poor hygienic conditions, rats, lousy food, and at times unscrupulous guards who profited from the prisoners or from their relatives. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul refers, some might even say brags at times, about the many times he was imprisoned. 2 Corinthians gives evidence of that. Now let's return to Luke's account and consider the broader story. Jesus is back in Nazareth at the synagogue. An image from our experience that comes to mind is one of a beloved seminary student, perhaps, who returns home to church after graduation, and the congregation is all excited, and they say things like, "Well, you look at this. Isn't this Joseph's son all grown up? We've heard great things about you, by the way. We're so pleased that you are back home to do the good here that we've heard about." No doubt there was some in the back in a low voice who said, "Now his father's a carpenter and his mother's a homemaker." Now those are some powerful stories about all this wisdom and power that he had. I'm just saying. I'm just saying. You know that church people are like that. They honored Jesus by inviting him to read from the prophetic scroll and say a word or two. And Jesus did not disappoint. He stood and read from Isaiah 61. And I focus on those phrases of Isaiah. Luke says in verse 22, just after our passage today, that all spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his mouth. And then the scene takes a dramatic turn, and all the pleasantries come to an abrupt end. In effect, Jesus tells this congregation, hanging on his every word, that he didn't come to bring them the good news that he proclaimed from the prophetic scroll. The good news of release from captivity and restoration to wholeness is intended to go from there out to those who have absolutely nothing. It is intended for outsiders. Moreover, Jesus locates this ministry theologically by telling familiar stories, stories of a time of judgment on Israel. It was a time in Israel's history when there was great need. Israel suffered from severe famine, outbreaks of leprosy and disease, terrible poverty. And during this time of judgment, God sent prophets from Israel to heal outsiders, to cleanse Gentiles. God did not forsake her children. Rather, God's children are so often obstinate and refuse to hear. They misperceive. Time and time again, God tells them to pay attention and to be faithful. The rejection of God by an obstinate people was the occasion for God's day of judgment. But that corrective judgment in no way eclipsed the year of Jubilee. God remained faithful to Israel and promised not only to restore Israel, but also to give Israel as a light to the nations. Isaiah 49:6 reads, "I will give you as a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth." Luke tells us in the larger story that the crowd grew exceedingly angry. They were filled with rage. Had they not recognized him as Joseph's son? Had they not invited him to read from the prophetic scroll? Had they not spoke well of him? Were they not amazed at his gracious words? So after Jesus spoke, they got up, drove him out of town, and led him to the brow of a hill to kill him. But Jesus managed to pass through their minds, to pass through their midst, and go on his way. When they thought they knew who Jesus was, they welcomed him. When he read from the prophetic scroll, the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. When he sat down to teach and proclaimed that the prophecy was fulfilled in their hearing, they praised him. But when Jesus, filled with the power of the Spirit, taught them what this anointing meant, what the inbreaking of God's will and work meant, then they rejected him and this ministry to outsiders. What did Jesus teach about bringing good news to the poor, the afflicted, the oppressed that filled them with such anger? That God would share a deliverance promised to us with outsiders is as much a stumbling block in our contexts as it was in Luke's context. Given this historical context, what is the good news that we have been charged to share with prison residents and returning citizens? Should we say that Jesus frees people from sin, but not from the politics of hyper-incarceration? Should we say that Jesus restores souls, but not civil rights? Only the governor has the power to do that? Theologically, many in the church today understand God's judgment as an authoritative word for prison residents and returning citizens, but not God's mercy. How often we try to make God's deliverance serve our own comfort. We chain it to our wrists so that it doesn't go out to the ones we hold in contempt, to the undeserving ones. But God breaks those chains. Ethically, we fail to show neighbor love when we are unmoved by the disenfranchisement and suffering of our neighbors. Reverend Dr. Harold Dean Trulier, when he spoke here at a Black Church Studies conference on mass incarceration and restorative justice, he asked a very simple question. He says, your church likely has a prayer and visitation list for persons who are sick and shut in. Does it have a prayer and visitation list for prisoners, persons in jail, for returning citizens? If not, why not? For some, the former, the sick and shut-ins, are undeserving of their suffering. But prisoners and returning citizens are not. We are called to break every chain. This includes the chain of disenfranchisement and second-class status. This includes the chain of stigmatization that permanently follows returning citizens and limits their life prospects. This includes the chain of marginalization that is the occasion for the school-to-prison pipeline. Prison residents and returning citizens cannot be a null curriculum in our curriculum. We are called to build just community. This includes welcoming returning citizens into our ecclesial communities and releasing them from the dark dungeon of isolation and alienation. This includes befriending returning citizens. This includes a year of jubilee that reorders our judgments and resets our priorities. This includes a day of atonement for the ways that we participate naively in systems that oppress people who have paid their debt to society. Perhaps jubilee in our midst means for us an inbreaking of the spirit that helps us to undo the damage we have done and allowed to be done to our neighbors. We are called to break every chain. We are called to break every chain and love our neighbors as ourselves. We're called to break every chain. And the neighbor love command is not abrogated by any scarlet letter or theological affirmation that fails to take into account the social and political times in which we live. We are called to break every chain.